My name is Jeanette, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. Well, really, my friends and my family, everyone calls me Nettie, and you guys are family. So my name is Nettie, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. This is amazing. This is beyond what I ever could have expected. What it was like, what happened, and what is it like now? So, like, I'm just going to open my mouth. AA was here for me. AA was here. Sobriety date, February 18th, 2008. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is Michelle W. My sponsor has a sponsor, and we are all currently working steps. So I was always taught to say that as well. So in thinking about this topic, I really did not even try and think about it because this is crazy. So I didn't try and think about it until probably 2 weeks ago because I've known and had the email for months. And so I started talking to my sponsor about it and she was like, no, you need to start considering it. You need to really start working. You need to really think of, you know, what do you need to say? And so what I need to say is that AA was here for me. So I think about when I first got here. And actually, when I think about the whole gay thing and I think about me, I think about when I first got here and how this topic completely intertwined with everything that I am. When I first got here, I remember the day that I went in. I kind of checked myself into rehab, and I don't really want to get into a drunk-a-law because you guys know all of that stuff, right? I can tell you when it stopped working, because it did work for a while. Actually, it worked for quite a while. I was 43 when I got here, so I'm old. And so I remember going to rehab and checking myself into rehab. And I actually went through some outside help. And the literature talks a lot about some outside help. So I had went through my psychologist, and my psychologist, you know, told me to stop. And honestly, I'm a healthcare professional, and I have a license, and I was really, really concerned about that. Because I was bringing alcohol to work lunchtime, you know? And so she said to me, well, I know the director of the rehab. And she said, what I'm going to do, I'm going to have you come in and we're going to have a session. And because she knew him personally, she had him come in the session and he kind of did an assessment. And he said to me, well, I think that you can do this outpatient-wise. And so I was grateful that I could do it outpatient because I didn't really want my job to find out or any of that. So I'm a veteran. And so I decided to use my veteran benefits for this purpose. And so the VA, and this is pretty typical of what's going on now, and it always has been, they said, we can get you in, but you need about 5 weeks. Right? They said, you need about 5 weeks to get you in. And I was like, 5 weeks? I can't stop. I can't stop now. So the counselor said to me, you need to go to AA. You need to go to AA. She gave me a meeting list, and she said, you need to go to AA. And I was desperate, guys. I was thirsty, and I said, whatever I have to do. You know, like, I have 2 children, and I just remember the look on my daughter's face, and she said, Mom, what's going on with you? What's going on with you? So I said, 5 weeks, that's it. So I took the meeting list, And I looked at it, and there was a meeting on there, and it was at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center, and I said, I know where that is, right? No, in the community, I'm from Albany, New York. I actually just moved to Charlotte, and I love Charlotte. I just moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, but I drank and used in Albany, New York, and I got sober in Albany, New York. And so I was kind of out in the community, and so I knew at the community center there was a meeting, so I went to the meeting. I said, I'm going to go there Thursday night. And so it was a gay meeting. And actually, it was a men's meeting. So I walked in there, and I had my notebook, you guys, and I had my little... No. And I told them who I was. I'm a newcomer. I checked myself into rehab today, and they told me I had to go to AA. And they said, sit down, girl. Sit down. You don't need no notebook. Just sit down. Right? And there was this sense. There was this energy. There was this energy of just love. Like, they said, just sit down, Nettie. Sit down. Listen up. And that's what I did. And that's what I did. So I went. So my first meeting in AA was a men's meeting, gay meeting. And you men love me. You love me up. You love me up. You was crying with me. You were checking out my hair. You checking out my shoe. But you love me up. And for that, I am forever, ever grateful. And so I continued my whole first year in Albany was in the gay and lesbian community. There was a Tuesday night meeting. There was a Friday night meeting. And so what I really remember is that after about 3 months in the program, there was a Friday night meeting, and you get that to a point like, am I really going to be able to do this? I don't know how to do this. I can't. I really am. I don't have a life, you know. Friday night was really a place for me where I would just kind of get paid and check in the room. And the whole weekend was spent in the room for me. But there was a couple of women in that Friday night meeting. They're like, what are you doing? Where are you going? Actually, one of them's here, and she was the one who kind of said, stop leaving the meeting. Stop running out of the meeting. Come here, stay, and do the meeting after the meeting. And that's how I made it. Like that first year, the meeting after the meeting, we went to go get ice cream. We would go to the diner and take over the diner and laugh. And that's the way. That's the way I said, okay, I can do this. So having the softness and the kindness of my community made it easier for me to become really open in AA. So, like, AA already figured the gay and lesbian thing out when I was here, and I'm grateful. I am so grateful. So that's kind of what happened. And so, what is it like now, I guess? It's like this, 2015 International Convention, like not in a million years, but I imagine I have friends and family like all over the world. Like, you're my family. And that's what my life has been like. So I got a sponsor. Just back up just a little bit. I did get a sponsor, and I found my sponsor in the Tuesday night Big Book meeting, okay, and they said, find someone that has what you want, right? And the way that she walked across the room, and that's all it was. I wasn't feeling her, none of that. It was really like there's something about the way that she walked across the room. I said, I want that walk. Just peace and serenity. And so she said, if you want what I have, you have to do what I do. And so I've been blessed to have two big book sponsors. But anyway, she gave me a little contract, and the contract is exactly what I needed. She said, if I make a commitment to you, you make a commitment to me, I'm going to give it to you just the way that it was given to me. And I needed that, you guys. I needed it. I needed someone to tell me, you need to go to a big book meeting. You need to go to a step meeting. You need to go to an open meeting. You need to buy a big book. You need to buy a notebook. So all of these things is what she did for me. She said, these are the things you kind of go over with me at night. Page 88, step 11. Do that check-in. And she carried me. She carried me. She helped me to burn down those walls and really take a look at who Nettie was. I had a lot of internal consequences, and so I just can't share with you how grateful I am about having that experience. Like, really, sponsorship and how beautiful sponsorship is. So anyway, she really did got me through the 12 steps, and then we did the 12 traditions. And then we started working the 12 steps again. And that's what she said. This is a journey. This is a process. You're going to always be working some kind of steps. What I remember is, I remember those times when I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know what to do. I remember I'm thinking about the time when I had to make amends to my ex-husband. And I wasn't that wife. I wasn't the woman that, I mean, there's some things that I did that I just am not proud of. I regret, I wasn't the wife that I should have been. And I just remember that opportunity. And I called her on the phone. Like, it's amazing how God works, really, because you know how they said pray to get willing to do this amends. And he was like, I don't really want to do this. I don't really want to do this with him. So I just remember that I pulled up in a parking lot, and then he pulled up in a parking lot right behind me. I'm like, gosh, I wasn't that ready. But I called my sponsor. I called my sponsor, and I was like, just pray. Pray before anything, and pray for everything. So that's the kind of love that I'm talking about. That's the kind of carriage. That's the kind of message that I really want you to hear. Like, I got a lot of hope here in AA. I got so much hope. The biggest piece, and actually I was just thinking about, the flag ceremony yesterday. I was thinking about, there are people in countries that I can't pronounce and I don't know where they are, that are getting sober, that are using this thing, right? You know, it is. It really is. It's amazing. So I feel like I'm a little stumbling. I don't really know what to say. But what I want you to hear, and really, just one soul, just one person to know that because the Gay and Lesbian Community Center was there for me. So that's kind of how it worked. Like, that was my subpopulation, and then it helped me into the broader population of AA. Like, that is the message. Like, AA had already figured out this gay and lesbian thing, and all I had to do was show up. And that's what was really, really helpful. Like, you guys just said, just keep coming back, Nettie. Just keep coming back. We know you're crazy. We know you don't really want to talk to anybody. We know you don't really want somebody to get to know you. And I'm not even going to talk about the whole relationship kind of thing. Because, yes, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Right? What I do remember was, you just told me to keep coming back. Like, people helped me to open up. helped me to learn who I was. And at 43, you know, I had an idea of who I was already. And that was so wrong. That was so wrong. I was so different. Like, so now, this is who I am. Now I get to be that little kid again, right? Now I get to dance and jump in the street and go to church. You know, it is just a new way of living. And I didn't know that I needed a new way of living until I got here. And you all became my friends. So, like, I travel a lot for my job, for territory, and so I go to a lot of meetings, which is cool. Like, I go to a lot of meetings. But because of where I started in the Gay and Lesbian Community Center, or community, I always kind of look for a gay or lesbian meeting where I go. So, like, in Huntsville, Alabama, right? And in Charleston, it was a beautiful one. And so I think that, actually not think, I am absolutely sure that because of my start in little old Albany, New York, in that gay and lesbian community, that first year that really carried me, it has absolutely helped me to be this beautiful woman that I'm working on loving every day, every day. And it's here for you too. It is absolutely here for you too. So I'm done, you guys. Oh, one other thing, and since I have 3 minutes, this morning, this was the reading in the Daily Reflections. This was the gift that you guys have given me. I get to wake up and just pick up some literature and read it and start my day with a quiet time. So, July 4th. And let me just say, happy Independence Day. Everything I know about being free, I got here in AA. A natural faith. So deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. It's page 55 in the Big Book. I have seen the workings of the unseen God in AA rooms around the country. Miracles of recovery are everywhere in evidence. I now believe that God is in these rooms and in my heart. Today, faith is natural for me, a former agnostic, which I am not, as breathing, eating, and sleeping. The 12 steps have helped to change my life in many more ways, but none is more effective than the acquisition of a higher power. Thanks for letting me share.
Let's thank Nettie again. I remember at my first gay meeting, I had about 6 months sober, and I was so scared to go. And this guy came up, his name is Dino, and he came up to me trying to give me a hug, and like I pushed him away, and I said, my sponsor said no sex my first year. But I felt welcomed. And so I just want to say thank you. And our next speaker is Tim from New York via Hong Kong via Miami.
Yay. All right now. My name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Which is why I need the fellowship of AA. Unfortunately, I still think, which is why I need the program of AA. And I'm really just blown away. I'm so grateful to be here, to be part of this. It's pretty overwhelming just to be asked to speak. And hopefully you're not saying, you're wondering why I was asked to speak either at the end of this as well. I want to thank Nanny. I thought that was great. I worked step 6 and 7 to try to listen to her, so I wasn't doing my own qualification. which is what I usually do, and also to be part of a group with Rosemary and Nanny. I found out that Rosemary and I probably partied at the same time in Atlanta. And as a friend said, I'm in the middle of a lesbian sandwich, which is exactly where I want to be. Because let me tell you something. In my experience, the women, the gay women, the lesbians of this community, not only in AA, have been so instrumental, and I'm so happy to see him there. Because I was in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and it was the women that I saw that stood up and helped us in those times of need. So, I'm really grateful. The last time I was in front of this many gay people in Atlanta, I was dancing on a speaker in Backstreet. And I was probably buying stuff from Rosemary. And to be here is such an honor, I can't tell you. I fell in love with AA, and AA has given me back everything I could possibly imagine. My sobriety date is August 9, 2001. My sponsor is here. His name is John. If I make mistakes, you can see him afterwards. I have sponsees that are here from Hong Kong. My sponsee was so kind to tell me I have a fear of speaking in public, and I'm up here. And I said, what happens if I go up there and faint? And he says, well, they'll remember you, and that's what you want anyway. And then he says, you get to speak about yourself, which is your favorite topic. So Simon needs a new sponsor after the meeting, so you can meet him. Is there anybody in here with under a year of sobriety? Can you raise your hand? Wow. So you're either crazy or you have good sponsorship. But thank you for coming. To be able to come here in your first year of sobriety is incredible. And the newcomer, you know, what you learn here is all about the newcomer, because the only way we get to find the glory is by giving of ourselves. And the only way we can really give is to give to people that are new, because in sharing the message, we get it back. And I've had such a privilege of sponsoring guys and watching the lights come on. You know, there's no greater joy. I mean, I had a lot of joy out there, don't get me wrong. You know, I danced under the stars, high, drinking with my fellows in the bonds of manhood, you know. It was fun. But the joy I've gotten in this program, where I was able to get outside of myself and to share that, that's really been the incredible. And I want to talk about the topic, but I also want to just talk about, you know, just to give you a little imprint of my story. I was born a gay, needy alcoholic in Kentucky to religious parents. I was already set up for a four-step. I mean, I had the makings right there. And I heard something in a meeting a couple weeks ago, which I absolutely loved. It said, I had a bad childhood until I was about 2 years sober. Because it wasn't until I was able to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to realize how lucky I've been. And how I was just a victim of everything, my potential and everything. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I have those steps. My first experience with drink, in Kentucky, you know, if you're up late, they give you a little bourbon to go to bed, even at a young age. But my first real drink, I was in my freshman year of high school. And it was the dance where the seniors leave and the freshmen have the dance. Some odd, you know, thing they have. And I got my older brother to buy beer for me and my friends. And we drank all this beer. And oh my God, I came alive. Because being a gay, needy, you know, future alcoholic, I needed the drink. I needed a drink at like 3. You know, the drink saved my life. Because I was so full of hatred of who I was and the feelings inside that I didn't understand. And nobody could give me enough attention. Even ask my partner, or actually my husband. It's legal in Georgia now. Ask my husband. I'll avoid the 10th tradition on that. But, you know, I felt alive. And I remember then we went to the dance. Things didn't go so well. The girlfriend I had, I somehow knocked her off the bleachers. And that was my success with women. And my high school football coach who was there grabbed me and said, "You have a problem. I'm 14 years old." And he said, "I want you to tell your parents that you got drunk tonight because I'm going to call them on Monday." I forgot about it. On Monday, my coach calls my dad and asks to speak to him. And I'm like, holy shit. I mean, he actually called. And he told my parents I was an alcoholic at 14 years old. There's a long time between that and the time I got here, but it was an early indication. And but I have to say, you know, being a person that finds that they're attracted to men in the 70s, before Will and Grace, you know, and certainly before the internet, you know, I used to pray that God would take my life because I thought, you know, I had a God of my parents' understanding. And as good of a job as they did, that God didn't have any place for me. And I would pray that God would take my life because I knew that I was attracted to people of the same sex. And so when I picked up the drink, you know, it gave me relief. And going to gay bar alcohol, oh, heaven. And the best part, I go to the lesbian bars and then they buy me the drinks. You know, like they get me all amped up and then send me off to the men's bar. God bless you guys. Just one other, you know, my journey is probably the same as yours. I mean, I did a lot of other things too. And for a while, I didn't know I was an alcoholic because when you're so tweaked out that you can't have a blackout drunk, you know, you forget you're an alcoholic. And I actually came in through a different fellowship and I caught alcoholism. You know, and I realized that I suffer from the ism of I, self, and me, which I still suffer from today. And that's why I need the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I stay in the middle of it. Because, you know, I don't wake up and it's like, oh, it's a sunny morning. I wake up thinking what I don't have, what I might lose, what you have that I want. You know, and I have to have the tools at my feet. And I didn't find those. So when I showed up, actually, I knew by 1999, my sober date's 2001, I knew by 1998, 99, I had to stop, it wasn't working. I had so many shameful experiences of where I wasn't going to drink, I wasn't going to drink, I wasn't going to drink, I wasn't going to drink. I swore I wasn't going to drink and I picked up a drink. And for me, a drink became something else, which usually took me someplace else, which usually meant I needed to be on penicillin for a week. And I did it over and over again. And I wanted so bad to quit. And so I finally showed up. I went to some meetings. You know, by the way, if you go to a straight meeting and you say where you've been over the weekend and they don't, they're like, is that a Turkish bathhouse? You know? So, you know, I have a lot of gratitude for gay AA because it gave me a lot of an open door for me to be able to relate. But when I was a couple weeks sober, my best girlfriend, Ava, who I call her the fairy godmother of the gay AAs, was speaking in a meeting. I thought she was a lesbian, I'll be honest with you, which was why I was immediately attracted to her. She's not a lesbian, just... Yeah. And she said, you know what, you should actually try like working the steps and reading this thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she turned me on to, you know, she knew that I was one of these people you couldn't tell me what to do. So she had to like, you know, plant the seed and then I'd have to make it, it had to be my idea. And she turned me on to speaker tapes. So if you're new or if you're in between meetings or if you're traveling, we have so many speaker tapes. And so I started to listen to these speaker tapes where people actually had the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they talked about this redemption and this happiness and this joy Because when you took the alcohol and the drugs out of me, I was freaking out. Because I went back to that pre-14-year-old where I felt, you know, lonely and not a part of. And that loneliness, that hole that we talk about, you know, that's overwhelming. And if I go back there, I have to drink, because drinking was a solution to my alcoholism. And what I started to do was go on the journey of the steps, which allowed me the ability to do stuff like find a different God. You know, I don't have a homophobic God. You know, I had to find a God that could wrap around me. And I could do that in this program. You know, somebody taught me how. They're like, just write down the things you don't want God to be, and they're gone, right? I was like, that easy. And then the third step, relieve me of the bondage of self. I never realized that was my thinking. The old idea, you're a piece of crap, you're not good enough, you know. And I was the people pleaser. I would suck you in to be nice to me, and then I wouldn't show up. And I wondered why you were like, had resentments. You know, I got to learn that stuff. And I found out in the fourth step that my problems were of my own making. And I love the setup in the third step where it says selfishness, self-centeredness, you know, 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. This is our problem. The alcoholic suffers from self-will run riot. And then my favorite line after this is, although sometimes he doesn't think so. Because God forbid you give us all the information, and then we're like, nah, I don't think so. Not me. That's not me. Until I get my head bashed again. And then the fifth step, I was able to be completely honest with somebody, you know, about the things that happened. And there was, you know, there were some things that happened. And now I share it, you know, from the podium. Appropriately in the right place, because I had to learn that as well. I'd overshare, and they'd be like, that was an overshare. Been told that a few times. You know, in 6 and 7, I got a change. I was able to become aware of the things that I was doing wrong, that when I was acting in self, and believe, I can act in self. I'll give you a great example. I was on a plane recently, and a four-year-old that was sitting across from me was clicking his seatbelt to annoy me. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he clicked it again. And he knew it was annoying me. And then I thought, could I punch him in the head? Was his mother not looking? You know, and I'm thinking, well, what would a sober person do? They probably wouldn't fight with a four-year-old. But that's, you know, I suffer from that. That's sometimes that's the best of my sobriety, is the fact that I didn't hit the four-year-old. Just a couple few, you know, 8 and 9, it's I got to have relationships with people. What I didn't realize in 8 and 9 is that I'm the one that benefits. You know, these people like the ex-boyfriends, the people that I had thought had harmed me, I was tethered to them. I was completely they occupied real estate in my head. I didn't realize until I actually did the amends, I became free. And that's why the promises in the 9th step sit behind the 9th step amends, because I become free. You know, this journey's been incredible. And 4-ish years ago, I got the opportunity to move to Hong Kong. I was living in Miami. I got sober in New York. I moved to Miami. I have a beautiful partner who had a citizenship issue, which is resolved now. Thank you. We were married 3 years ago. And I went there, and I got involved in Hong Kong AA, which was not gay AA. You know, I think there's people that go to gay that doesn't even know that they're straight AA. You could wrap yourself in, and they're like, are there straight people in AA? I don't know. I've never seen one. And there's a lot of them here. And these people, I have to tell you, I went to the first meeting in Hong Kong. No one, they didn't like me. No one greeted me. They didn't know who I was. No one gave me a party. I went back the next day and I started to share. I started to do service. And boy, what an experience to be part of a fellowship like that. And I started to sponsor straight guys. And I love, and to have it, and to watch the same thing come alive. And there's this one guy, he would be like, he's like, well, you're gay, can you sponsor me? I'm like, well, do you want to sleep with me? He goes, no. I'm like, I can sponsor you. I don't want to sleep with you either. And to watch him, and I'm always like, you know, you're exactly like me. And he goes, you freak me out when you say that. I'm like, except for the part. But, you know, one of the things that happened too is that the gay people within Hong Kong AA, we weren't really out, and so I'm pretty out. And we became very much a part of the whole, which is the theme tonight. And we've been part of the whole. And you know, I've heard it. You can clap to that. If you learn a little bit about the history of AA, there's some really incredible things. One is that Bill Wilson, the speaker yesterday morning, started to speak about it. In his speech in 1968, talked about in year number two of AA, it's year 80, year number two, a person came in that was gay to the room. They call this sexual deviance. And he came into where Dr. Bob was, and they had a group conscious. And at that time, they said, if he has a desire to stop drinking, he's welcome. That was 1937. Now, think of where we've come from there. And it's in the acceptance. And there's, if you also haven't heard, there's a guy, Barry L., who spoke 30 years ago at this convention on the third tradition. Look him up. Google him. Listen to his talk. And it talks about the history of gay AA. And it was in 1973 that they first labeled gay meetings. Think about 1973. They weren't even letting gay people out. I mean, we were out, but, you know, they weren't. And in 1980, they had the first gay meeting at the convention. We've been very much a part of the whole. We've been accepted here. We've been loved here. And I think it's our responsibility to be real and good members of AA. You know, I'm taught that I extend my hand to anybody, even the people that don't agree with me. And Barry said something in his speech, I listened to it recently, he said, you know, even those Florida beauty queens we have to accept, 1985. And the same is true today. When it comes to AA, no matter what your belief is, we have to be open and accepting. And as much and as grateful as I am, and as much as I may not have the same opinion as people, if it comes to AA, I'm willing to be a service. And it's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. Seriously, I never, you know, again, think I'd be here being asked to speak. I'm humbled by it because I'm sure after you've heard me, a lot of you got better stories and more sobriety. You know, I feel wrapped in love. I feel a part of. I don't feel apart from. I feel accepted. I feel valuable. And I do that being outwardly gay. When I got married 3 years ago, the executive team in my work threw a shower for me. You know, I cried. And when I heard the announcement a week ago, I cried. Because in my lifetime... Hey, guys. But beyond that, the greatest thing that ever happened to me is I got freedom from bondage of self, from my thinking. And I have tools today because, for sure, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and remember everything I didn't say and be in my head. But I have a sponsor and I have the tools at AA. And I love you guys and thank you so much for listening to me.
So let's thank Tim again. Way to keep clapping. And one of the things he mentioned was about straight people who've welcomed us in. And I know that there are straight people here today. And I just want to say thank you from this gay person for welcoming me into your meetings and letting me be as gay as I needed to be in front of you. So thank you. So our next speaker is Rosemary from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey, y'all. That's what we say here in the South. You know, I first off, I want to just say this, and I want you all to say this with me. I'm an alcoholic. If I say I am, bottom line, I have a good friend whose father used to say to her, just bottom line me. Don't tell me the whole story, just bottom line me. And the bottom line is, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a child of God, number one. I'm an alcoholic, number two. I'm a person, number three. Number four, I don't really, I mean, I maybe I've just gotten to the age that I don't really care what you call me. But I don't really like labels. I hate that word lesbian. But my name is Rosemary and I'm an alcoholic. I have been sober since January the 7th, 1985. I'm 67 years old. So I'm pretty grateful in both areas. One to be that sober and one to still be alive. I'm going to tell you a little bit about me, but I also, you know, when you have friends in your life, you never know what they're going to say. So I get in the car, or my friend gets in the car this morning to ride over with me, and she said, oh, I love your outfit. That's what you're going to speak in? She's actually my best friend. Or she probably wouldn't have gotten away with saying that. You know, we get them from Yale and we get them from jail. And every place in between, and all of us here have come from one of those two places, from Yale or jail and in between. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my past and what really makes me want to be a part of the whole of AA. I don't want to be separate. I've been separate all my life. When I was a little kid and I was raised by an alcoholic father and a pill-taking mom who did not want me, left me at the hospital for 3 days before they came and picked me up. And when I was 5 years old, I realized there was something different about me, but I was a country girl. I didn't know what the devil it was, but I knew something was different. But when I was a little kid and they would drink and fuss and fight, I would get a blanket and put it over a coffee table. And I would get under it. And if you wanted to talk to me, you had to get under there and whisper. Because I was so afraid. I spent most of my adult life that way. Under a blanket, talking very quietly. Over here. Because I needed to feel safe. I could be in a bar with 1,000 people and there'd be nobody there but me. Anybody ever felt that way? Being raised in a family like that that did not want you, didn't care for you, didn't do nursery rhymes, little books and all that jazz, had a profound effect on the way the rest of my life turned out. When I was at the age of 5, I began being molested by my brother. And I told my mother, and she told me to shut up and get out of the kitchen. So I shut up and got out of the kitchen. And I never returned to the kitchen. I still don't know how to cook. And that may be one of the reasons. I don't know. That molestation lasted for a long, long time, and I'll tell you that a little bit later in my story. I was really ignored, and, you know, I was a tomboy. I wanted to feed the chickens, ride the horse, you know, feed the cows, slop the hogs. I'm from the country. And that was not my mother's idea. My mother, of course, wanted a little girl with pink Philly dresses and little Mary Jane shoes and all that stuff. And I got to wear that one time a year. That was, I don't know about y'all, but did y'all have to go to church on Easter Sunday? Okay. That's the only time I had to go to church. It's also about the only time that I got put in really pretty dresses. And I looked like I was plowing a mule walking down the aisle. And I remember being laughed at by the girls because I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in sports. I played them. I played tennis. I played softball. My little short ass played basketball. But when I would go down into them, and some of you may have experienced this, when I would go down to change clothes, I didn't know how to wear makeup. I didn't know anything about rolling my hair. I'd never been taught any of those things. And I would stand in a corner with my back to everybody and put my clothes back on because I was so ashamed. So my life up until I was 19, I started drinking probably around 16. My dad was an alcoholic. And my father ran around on my mother. Now, they remind you, they stayed married and died with 53 years being married. But my father ran around on my mother all the time, and he drank like a maniac, and I swore I'd never grow up to be like him. Never. I grew up to be just like him. I drank a lot of alcohol, and I chased a lot of women. Sorry, Helen. And I caught a lot, and that's a whole another program and another story. What happened when, at 19 years old, I had been drinking since 16. I've been stealing alcohol from my father, and I had a 55 Ford, and we'd get in that, and we'd drive over to a place called McDonough that says we're right around the square. Well, it's not a square. It's a circle, but we all called it a square, and we'd do that on Friday and Saturday nights with 50 cents worth of gas, and we'd go to the bootlegger and buy tall Budweiser beers for $2 a can. And I would do all that because I just wanted to be accepted. I would provide the money, I would provide the transportation, just so you would accept me. So I would look like I had some friends, because I never had any friends. I lived in the country, all around boys. The molestation was continuing and getting worse, because now it was other family members, not my father, thank God. So at 19 years old, my family calls me to a family meeting, and they said, you're going to have to give your life to Jesus Christ or you're going to have to leave. I'm like, hell, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Now, I didn't know at 19 what the word gay, lesbian, all. I really don't like all those initials. I am a gay woman. That's what I am. We are gay people. That's what we are. And I guess if you need to have other little tags on you, that's fine, but I'm gay, and I stand here loud and proud. But I'll tell you what else I am. I'm a member of the world. I'm a member of society. I'm an active member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that will continue one day at a time. At 19, I headed myself to Atlanta, and all hell broke loose then. My drinking really escalated. Because then I was in my own apartment, I was working, I could buy all the booze I wanted. At that time, the legal age was 18. And by 23, I was throwing up blood, because I drank so much, I already had eaten an ulcer into my stomach. So, I cracked up. I went to a doctor, and they said, well, you can't do this, and you can't do that. You can't eat this. You can't eat barbecue. You can't drink alcohol. You can't eat fried foods. I didn't hear anything about the alcohol. I mean, I heard it, but it didn't make an impact on me. So I thought, okay, I won't do those things because I'm dying. I can't. I'm so sick, I can't stand myself. So, 3 days after I'm not drinking alcohol, I'm sitting at my desk and everything flies apart because I'm in full-blown DTs. I've been drinking 24 hours a day for a long time by that time and going to gay bars at night. We don't know anything. Y'all don't know anything about that, do you? Okay. That's where I lived my life. The minute I found them, I'm like, oh, my God. And I found them in 1972. I came out in 1972. To anybody who wanted to know. You know, I never run up to anybody and said, "Hi, my name's Rosemary, and I'm a gay woman." I don't think Helen ever run up and said, "Hey, my name's Helen, and I'm a straight woman." You know, it's one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're all nuts on the same bus. You know, there is no differential between you, them, and I spent my whole life feeling like I was different and less than. And as my life progressed, it continued to fall apart. Because I ended up in a psychiatrist's office, and they got out the prescription pad, and guess what? Who needed a drink? Because they were giving me prescriptions. Took the edge right off. I thought, hey, well, this is not bad. So I continued to go to bars. About a year later, I got mad at the psychiatrist because all he wanted to talk about was my mother, and I fired him. Only problem, it didn't dawn on me that I needed these pills. Because now I had something else going on. So, I met somebody who introduced me to other things that we're not going to talk about because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want singleness of purpose to just have a heart attack right here in the room. But I can tell you that for a number of years, I operated under different kinds of liquid alcohol. I earned my living for 10 years selling illegal things. And that could mean anything. I mean, it could mean stolen goods, but you read into that whatever you want to. I didn't work a job. That was my job. I had 35 people working for me. I carried guns. Most of them go, "No, you didn't." Yes, I did. I'm an old granny, but I carried guns, and I shot place people up, and I would shoot the bar up if they owed me money. Y'all know how that goes. I mean, you've been there. Well, maybe it didn't all carry guns, but I carried guns. So, and also by that time, I had started back drinking again. Now, my family kicked me out at 19, so I had no relationship at all. I was a loner. I could be in a room, as I say, we had a bar called The Cove back then. I don't know how many of you are from Atlanta, but I could stand in front of one of those speakers, and there would be 1,000 people on the dance floor, and I would be totally alone. Totally alone. Which is how I remember being from the time I was about 3 years old. Totally alone. Nobody cared for me. Nobody wanted me. And that's how I lived my life. I just believed that. So I never even tried to build relationships because I thought, hell, nobody wants me. Let me check. But I'm doing all right. Okay. So 1972, when I found the bars, I thought, hot dang. Boy, I have hit gold here. Now, these are people like me. But I didn't know what that meant. So I remember 1972 sitting out in the parking lot, taking me 30 minutes to go inside to this bar. And I went inside this bar, and this person came up, and I was with somebody, by the way, said, "You guys can hold hands in here." And I'm like, holy crap, are you serious? Because I got to tell you, we've come a long way. 1972, it was not popular. I would come out of that bar, and they'd put me in the back of a police car. And they start questioning me. "What are you doing in there?" "Nothing." "What were you drinking?" "Nothing." "Who were you with?" "Nobody." "How long you been there?" 5 minutes. "I've probably been there 5 hours. And it was just to harass. They didn't have any reason to lock me up. It was just to harass me. And that went on for a number of years until we became a force to be reckoned with. And I believe we became a force to be reckoned with due to economics. We started spending our money in the right places and people started paying attention. If you're in the city of Atlanta and you're in one certain area and you take all of the gay money out, you'll have nothing but a dust town. Because we support that part of town. I've done a lot of things in my life I'm ashamed of. One of the things I did during that 10 period, I became a thief. Not because I was making plenty of money, but because I lived on the edge, right on the edge, just right before you fall off. You know what I mean, right before you fall off. And when I couldn't get that, I would create it. So I started stealing. I would steal house plants that were on the porch. people's porch furniture. I ran what's called Rosemary's Midnight Auto Supply. We'd be sitting at the bar, and a friend of mine would say, "You know what? My battery's about gone." I said, "What kind of car you got?" I carried those big bolt cutters in my car, and back then you could open the engine from the outside, not all that inside pulling stuff. So I just opened the engine, cut the battery cables, and go back to the bar and say, "Here's your battery. How much do you owe me?" "Nothing." I never charged money for it. I think it was, "Somebody catch me. Somebody stop me. Please, somebody stop me." They didn't. And it kept getting worse. They kept getting worse. And it kept getting worse. And I thought, I can't keep living this way. I can't keep living this way. I wanted to talk to my mama, but she told me to shut up and get out of the kitchen. I will tell you now that, no, I'm not going to tell you now, I'll tell you later, so you'll have to stay. It got so bad to go from such a, quote, money-making enterprise to standing at the dumpster at the back of the Claremont Lounge. I don't know if any of you know where that is, begging for dollars. Now, mind you, I'm living in a high-rise, but I had paid the rent in 4 months. 1984, I don't remember from October, November, December. I don't know where I was. I don't know who I was with. I have no idea. I just know that I woke up the 1st or 2nd of January. People say, "Oh, you waited until after New Year's." I didn't even know it was New Year's. I don't know that I knew it was January. And I said, "I can't be me anymore. I can't stand me another minute. Every toy in my toy box is broken. Everything's broken. And I can't get any of it to work." So I went out on my balcony and I put one leg over. And my high-rise looked down on the Fox Theater and I saw the Fox marquee. And the dangest thing happened. I couldn't get my other leg up. As hard as I tried, I couldn't get my other leg up. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, I know what hell is like. Hell is when you can't live and you can't die. And that's where I was in hell. I thought, you don't even have the guts to kill yourself. You can't keep going. So I just decided I would go to bed and never wake up again. Which is what I did. Unfortunately, I had a few using friends that checked on me and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm dying. I don't want to live anymore." And they're like, and they called another friend, and another friend called another friend, and the next thing you know, somebody's at my house, and I'm being thrown into the shower, because God knows how long it had been since I showered. I don't know how long it had been since I'd eaten. And they take me over to a place called Georgia Regional for a evaluation. And I'm like, I don't know what y'all are talking about. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't even know y'all existed. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous at all my whole life. They did an evaluation on me, and as they were writing down the things that I had done, when he turned over to the back of the page and was still writing, he said, "I think that's enough. I think I got enough. I think the problem here is that you're an alcoholic and you have other problems." And I said, and listen to this. I said, "Yes." I don't even know where that came from. That was the first God moment of my life. I said, "Yes." I don't really remember picking up my white chip. I picked one up. I remember that. But I don't remember the day. I remember going to the meeting. I remember them talking about a big book. I looked all over the room because, you know, church folks have these big Bibles on these stands. And I thought that's what they were talking about. So I'm looking everywhere for this big book. And I don't see no big book. And I'm looking at that. And so I asked the person, "What are they talking about?" And he shows me this little blue book. And I'm like, I don't get that. Because my withdrawals from everything were so bad that for 6 months I was unemployable. So I went to 4 meetings a day. I thought they were going to charge me rent. And I started going to the gay clubhouse because I didn't know where else to go. I didn't have any straight friends, you know. I had no place else to go. So I'd go to 4 meetings a day. I had lost my driver's license, lost my Social Security card, was basically unemployed, hadn't paid taxes for 10 years. So for 6 months, I lived in a halfway house, a state-run halfway house, not a paid-for halfway house, with 8 girls in one room on hospital cots. I've never been so glad to be somewhere in my whole life, because when I went back to get my things at that fancy little high-rise, I can't believe it. They changed the locks and got rid of all my stuff. And I'm like, but that was mine. They're like, yeah, but you hadn't paid rent in 4 months. So I started this fellowship with a pair of blue jeans, a sweatshirt, the tennis shoes I had on, and that was it. Not even a coat. Certainly not a suitcase. Certainly not a car. With nothing. Which I have to tell you is the best damn way in the world to start this program. If you start with nothing, there's no way to go but up. I also will tell you that family is not a requirement for sobriety. You can get and stay sober without family. I made it to 8 years, and I decided to make amends to my mother, and I did. My father never spoke a word to me. I have served in every capacity, a group level that I can think of. I started out in gay AA, but at about 10 years sober, I felt like something wasn't right. I still felt separate from. And I felt that way my whole life. I wanted to feel a part of, not separate from. So I changed my meetings. I went to meetings where there were straight people. And you know what? They didn't say, "Are you gay? You can't come in here." Or, "Look at that woman over there. I think she's gay." You know? They were so open and so loving and so warm. Today, I'm a member of a straight AA home group. It works called the We've Had Enough group. It's a Biscayne room if any of you ever want to go there. Yay! You know, what happened is AA, this program has given me back a life, or a life that I never had. You guys wrapped your arms around me and you took all my broken toys. And you started putting me back together again. And you started putting me back together as a whole person. And I never had been a whole person. And year by year and step by step and sponsor and the fellowship, I started coming together and feeling like I was a member of the human race, which was for the first time. And I was 37 years old at that time. I don't know where my life would be today without Alcoholics Anonymous. Over the last 30 years, I've experienced a lot of good things and a lot of bad things. The bad things were, at 22 years sober, I had a nervous breakdown, and I'll tell you why. If y'all got any secrets out there, you better get them out. You better come on out with them. Or you'll be sitting in some psychiatrist's office. There was a secret that I was never going to tell. Ever going to tell. And whoops, there it was at 22 years sober. I was never going to tell anybody that truly I had been molested until I was 18 years old by probably 12 or 13 people, because I was ashamed. I thought, if you hear that, you're going to think, well, why didn't you stop it? Why didn't you do something? I don't know. I don't know. I did the best I could. I ended up in a therapist's office, thank God, and was diagnosed with PTSD, dissociative disorder. And what that means is that I can flip a switch and not be here. Watch this. Not here. How y'all doing? It doesn't happen nearly as often, because today I can stand behind a podium in any meeting in the city of Atlanta or any place in the United States, anywhere, and tell my entire story all the way up through that. And for that, I'm so eternally grateful. What it has done... I have not had one person, and it just kills me going straight A and gay A. Why can't we just be AA? See, that's what I don't understand. I mean, why can't we just be AA? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a life-saving, life-giving program, and we need to all pull together. You know, I don't care if you got on pink shorts or green hair. You know, I don't care. I mean, I looked up here today, and she's got on a dress, and he's got on a suit, and he's got on a suit. And I, look at me. But you know what? This is me. See, if you take the real you to an AA meeting, you'll be there. You'll be a part of it. If you go in expecting to be treated different, guess what? Like this morning when I got up and I dressed and I put on a little dress with spaghetti straps on it and I had some little slippers on. And my sponsor, Arthur, right here, who I love with all my heart, said, you know, that doesn't really look right, Rosemary. And I thought, I wore a dress 50 years ago. I have had major health problems. I have congestive heart failure. I have COPD. I have pulmonary hypertension. I have degenerative joint disease. I have osteoporosis and rheumatoid arthritis. So other than that, I'm in pretty good shape. I also am a breast cancer survivor. Yay! I had breast cancer in 2004, and they removed this big girl. I wish they'd remove this one, because I wouldn't fall nearly as much as I do. But, you know, the doctors did what they needed to do. If I give you any message today, it is to say that I love all of you, and that you are welcomed right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never have I been to a meeting that has ever been said, oh, no, they can't come in here. I've never heard that. I've never heard that. The only requirement for membership is what? What do you have? Me too. Thank you.